Greetings to you, our curious listener, and welcome to The Deep Dive. I'm Lee Garrison.
And I'm Charlie Olmsted.
Here, we take your sources, peel back the layers, and really try to unearth the most compelling insights. Think of it as a shortcut to being truly well-informed.
Yeah, my role is to help synthesize all that information, connect the dots, and explore not just, you know, what's happening, but why it matters and maybe what it means for the bigger picture.
And today, we're embarking on a pretty fascinating deep dive. We're looking at a very specific set of sources, the September 2025 issue of The Nation magazine. Consider this your exclusive guided tour through some of the most pressing political, social, and cultural conversations happening right now, all seen through the lens of this really iconic publication.
Right. Our mission here is to give you a thorough, comprehensive, really detailed report on the most impactful articles and topics in this issue. We'll discuss their significance, their implications, so you can walk away with a hopefully richer understanding of the forces shaping our world.
Okay, sounds good. Let's unpack this September 2025 deep dive into The Nation. So we begin with what feels like a really urgent editorial. It's from Ai-Jen Poo, titled, What's Next is Up to Us. It focuses on the American care system, and it marks 60 years since the Medicaid and Medicare Act.
60 years, wow.
Yeah. And what really strikes you immediately is the picture it paints. A safety net under immense, maybe even unsustainable strain. The core issue, as the editorial highlights, is a care system that's, well, on the brink. And this crisis is severely exacerbated by what's described as the largest cut to Medicaid in history.
That's a huge claim.
It is. And even before these cuts, the piece argues, the existing programs were clearly insufficient, often underfunded, and inaccessible to far too many people who need them.
Right. It wasn't exactly a perfect system to begin with.
Not at all. And the impacts are stark. They're deeply personal. Yeah. We're talking about millions struggling just to access basic care. And family caregivers are described as absolutely buckling under the immense financial and emotional costs. They're often sandwiched, you know, raising young children, supporting aging parents. It's an unsustainable burden for many.
That sandwich generation concept really resonates.
It does. And it's not just the families feeling the strain. Care workers themselves are earning poverty wages, forcing them to take second and third jobs just to support their own families.
Think about that irony.
Exactly. The very people providing essential care can't afford to live. The system is also failing those who need home care. The article mentions over 700,000 eligible families stuck on endless waiting lists.
700,000? That's staggering.
It is. And in rural areas, it's even tougher sometimes. Nursing homes are simply shuttering their doors because of critical workforce shortages.
So it's a crisis across the board, urban, rural, families, workers.
Pretty much. But what's truly fascinating in this editorial, I think, is how Ai-Jen Poo frames this moment. It's not just a crisis narrative. She presents it as a critical opportunity to fundamentally reshape the future of care in America.
Ah, okay. So not just doom and gloom, but a potential turning point.
Precisely. It provokes a vital question. How do we shift our collective mindset? How do we move from viewing care as really a burden or, you know, an individual responsibility to recognizing it as an essential societal investment?
Yeah.
Because if we connect this to the bigger picture, it suggests that our current underfunding isn't just inefficient. It's, well, it's a profound miscalibration of societal values, isn't it?
Yeah, that's a great way to put it.
Investing in care isn't just humanitarian. It's presented here as an economic imperative, one that could potentially unlock immense productivity and well-being.
Right.
The system's failure to support caregivers and recipients alike has this ripple effect that touches really every part of the economy and every family. This isn't just a social problem, the piece argues, but an economic one at its very root. Absolutely. It really makes you wonder what kind of national values we truly reflect when the people who provide such fundamental care are struggling just to survive themselves. Okay, so next, we shift gears a bit. We move to a compelling argument from Bhaskar Sunkara in his comment piece titled, Yes, It's the Populism.
Sunkara, okay.
Yeah, this article takes a sharp look at the American electorate, specifically focusing on working class voters. And it suggests the Democratic Party might be fundamentally misunderstanding them.
Okay, how so?
Well, Sunkara's core argument is pretty direct. Working class voters are not drifting right on economic issues. That's the key assertion.
Interesting. That counters a lot of common narratives.
Exactly. Instead, he asserts that Democrats are failing to engage these crucial voters precisely because of their reluctance to embrace genuine economic populism. And this is despite what some top Democrats might mistakenly believe about the working class's views.
So a disconnect between party leadership perception and voter reality.
That's the argument. The piece really tries to cut through some common misconceptions. It critiques what it calls team gentrification, a term reportedly used for advisors to figures like Hakeem Jeffries and Chuck Schumer, who dismissed Democratic Socialist candidates.
Team gentrification, huh? That's provocative language.
It is. But Sunkara counters this narrative with real-world examples. He cites Yohan Mamdani's success in attracting broad support by relentlessly focusing on working-class cost-of-living concerns.
Right, the recent NYC primary winner.
The very same.
Yeah.
And this success contrasts sharply with what Sunkara calls a distorted narrative that high-ranking Democrats seem to hold, imagining workers as inherently reactionary on economic matters.
Okay. Is there data to back this up in the piece?
Yes, absolutely. To underscore this, the article references a Center for Working Class Politics, CWCP, report. It analyzed data from three national surveys.
Uh-huh.
And it empirically shows that working-class Americans have actually grown more progressive over the past two decades, not just on economic justice, but also on immigration and civil rights.
More progressive? Over two decades?
That's what the report found, according to the article. And it strikingly concludes they are farther to the left than when it helped elect Barack Obama in 2008.
Wow. That really challenges a prevailing narrative within the Democratic Party, doesn't it?
It really does.
If working class voters are indeed economically progressive, as this report suggests, then the reluctance to explicitly champion economic populism isn't just, you know, a missed opportunity.
Right.
It's potentially a fundamental misreading of their political leverage. It highlights what could be a critical strategic miscalculation. And from a broader perspective, this suggests that economic issues might be a more powerful unifying force across different social and cultural views than is currently realized.
A unifying force despite other differences?
Potentially, yes. Uh-huh. It presents a clear strategic path, Sunkara argues, for a political party to rebuild a durable, lasting majority by focusing on the material conditions that resonate universally, rather than maybe focusing too much on perceived cultural divides.
So, the implication is that a strong, consistent economic message could cut through a lot of the political fragmentation we see.
That seems to be the core takeaway. It's not necessarily about changing voters' minds on social issues, but about meeting them where they already are on economic concerns. That's presented as a crucial distinction.
That makes a lot of sense, meeting them where they are.
Yeah.
Okay, moving to an issue that, maybe surprisingly, crosses the political spectrum these days. We have a piece by Representative Rokana titled Release the Files.
Ah, the Epstein files.
Right, exactly. This article zeroes in on government transparency and accountability, particularly concerning those files. The core argument Kana makes is that releasing these files isn't only crucial for bringing justice to the victims, which is obviously paramount.
Of course.
But also for the broader imperative of rebuilding public trust in institutions. Institutions that are, frankly, widely perceived by many as corrupt and unaccountable.
Yeah, that lack of trust is a huge theme right now.
It really is. Kana explicitly highlights this deep erosion of trust. He references, quite pointedly, Joe Rogan's direct question to Bernie Sanders. Why should people pay more taxes to an incompetent, corrupt government?
That's a blunt question, but it captures a sentiment.
It does. And the statistic cited is stark. Only 22% of Americans have faith that our leaders will do what is right. Just 22%.
Oof, that's incredibly low.
It is. And this profound distrust, Kana argues, has been fueled by decades of corruption and the unchecked influence of money in politics. The Epstein case in particular has become this potent symbol.
A lightning rod.
Exactly. The public's demand for transparency is overwhelming. According to the piece, 79% want the files released, and a majority believe the government is actively covering up evidence.
So the public perception is one of a cover-up.
That's what the polling suggests, yeah. And the refusal to release these files, Kana asserts, is just the latest example of how a lack of transparency fuels distrust. It feeds the narrative.
This piece really drills down into a foundational problem for any functioning democracy, doesn't it?
It seems to.
I mean, when public trust in institutions collapses to such low levels, like that staggering 22% figure, it fundamentally compromises the government's ability to govern effectively. Doesn't matter what policies they try to enact.
Right. The legitimacy is questioned.
Exactly. The Epstein case isn't just about one individual, as horrific as that is. It symbolizes a perceived lack of accountability and systemic corruption that directly undermines the public's willingness to support broader government initiatives.
Even ones that might help them.
Even ones intended to benefit them. It illustrates how a specific high-profile case can become a focal point for much wider societal disillusionment. Hmm. It creates this vicious cycle where distrust feeds a lack of support, which then makes it harder to address the very issues causing the distrust.
Mm-hmm.
It really makes you question the very fabric of democratic consent when the public loses faith in the integrity of its leadership.
So it's not just about what's in the files, necessarily, but what the lack of transparency signifies for public trust more broadly. That's a really powerful connection the piece makes. Okay, following that theme of accountability, we delve into an analysis of New York City politics. This is by Spencer Ackerman, titled Escape from Fear City. And it links post-9/11 tactics with contemporary class struggles.
Ackerman, okay, this sounds intense.
It is. The core argument here is that Zohran Mamdani's victory in the Democratic mayoral primary signaled a significant collapse of what Ackerman calls Islamophobic politics as usual.
Right.
But more profoundly, the piece argues it eliminated how the tools of the war on terror are the tools of class war.
Wow. Okay. That's a strong claim. Explain that connection.
Well, the argument is that the city's traditional elite, who got accustomed to wielding fear as a political weapon after 9/11, found their usual playbook utterly failed against Mamdani's campaign, which focused heavily on economic issues.
So the fear tactics didn't work this time?
Apparently not, according to Ackerman. The article describes a summer of fear in NYC, but this fear now extends to the city's wealthiest, who perceive their dominance threatened by Mamdani's rise.
Interesting inversion.
Yeah. Despite mega donors spending a reported $20 million post-October 7 on aggressive attack ads, their efforts to stop him came up empty.
$20 million. And it failed.
That's the report. But this fear is also described as palpable within immigrant communities. They face immense anxiety due to Immigrations and Customs Enforcement, or ICE agents,
mm-hmm.
grabbing law-abiding people at check-ins, or snatching Muslim New Yorkers off the streets for things like pro-Palestinian activism. The article describes ICE as shedding the fiction of targeting violent criminals.
So a broader net being cast.
That's the implication. And this state terror, as Ackerman calls it, was unleashed, he argues, with Mayor Eric Adams' explicit blessing after Adams allegedly agreed to cooperate with Trump's mass deportation agenda.
That's a heavy allegation.
It is, and it's presented as part of the political backdrop.
What's particularly striking in Ackerman's piece, listening to this, is how that national security rhetoric, initially associated with the war on terror, seems to morph into these sophisticated tools for domestic social control,
right?
Particularly against marginalized communities. This isn't just about immigration enforcement in isolation. It's presented as the repurposing of fear itself.
Fear is a tool.
Exactly. It suggests that perceived external threats, whether it was terrorism post 9/11 or immigration now, are often strategically repurposed to maintain existing power structures and potentially suppress movements for economic or social justice.
Mm.
Mamdani's success, viewed in this context, highlights how an organized, economically focused counter-narrative can potentially expose the underlying class conflict beneath the rhetoric of national security.
So punching through the fear narrative with economics.
That seems to be the dynamic Ackerman describes. It truly makes you consider how enduring these fear playbooks are, and maybe more importantly, what genuinely roots their hold on the public conversation.
That's a crucial question. So the idea is the war on terror wasn't just about foreign enemies, but became a kind of domestic blueprint for controlling dissenting voices or vulnerable populations. That's a pretty sobering thought. Okay, shifting gears now to something very personal. Our next deep dive explores the politics of healthcare, focusing on the hidden labor of bodies and the concerning logic of eugenics.
Okay, heavy topics.
Definitely. We're discussing a Q&A with medical sociologist Andrea Becker and Sarah Franklin, titled Simply Andrea Becker. The core theme that Becker masterfully weaves together is the interconnectedness of seemingly disparate medical practices, things like hysterectomy, abortion, and gender-affirming care.
How are those connected in her view?
She connects them through the lens of moral panics and what she identifies as a pervasive eugenics logic, a logic she argues is deeply rooted in historical white supremacy and patriarchy.
Eugenics logic. Wow, can you unpack that?
Yeah. Becker introduces a really powerful concept. She conceptualizes having a uterus as a relentless job, almost akin to the second shift of domestic labor that sociologists talk about.
A relentless job.
Okay. This framing highlights how healthcare often reduces these organs solely to their reproductive function. For example, she points out that diagnosing conditions like endometriosis is often easier if a patient mentions they're trying to get pregnant.
Ah, because then the organ's purpose is relevant to the doctor.
Exactly. Suddenly, the function doctors prioritize is at stake. But, Becker argues, if a patient simply wants a pain-free, happy life, their concerns, their pain, are often minimized or dismissed.
That points to a real tension many people must experience.
Absolutely. And this ties into her argument about eugenics. She stresses that attacks on both trans health and reproductive health have eugenics at their root.
How so? Can you give an example from the piece?
Sure. She differentiates between negative eugenics, think historical forced sterilization of Black, Brown, and poor people, upheld by the Buck v. Bell Supreme Court case, which chillingly have never been overturned.
Never overturned. Wow.
Yeah. And positive eugenics, which she describes as the desire to increase white births by limiting fertility access, like abortion and birth control for others, while promoting births among certain groups. The article explicitly mentions how migrant women in detention centers aren't seen as worthy of reproduction, leading to forced hysterectomies.
That's horrifying.
It is. And she also points to a growing pronatalist movement among highly educated white billionaires, seeking to increase birth rates of other white billionaires.
So it's a complex web of control over bodies framed by this eugenics logic.
That's the core argument. And it plays out in doctor-patient interactions, too. Becker's research suggests the more masculine a doctor perceives you to be, the more agency you have in a medical space, and your pain is taken more seriously.
That's deeply concerning.
It is. And she introduces her concept of the rowdy patient. When doctors fail, communities rely on each other for medical knowledge and tools. She cites examples like grassroots activism in Brazil for distributing misoprostol for safe medication abortions, and the historical Our Bodies Ourselves movement.
Ah, the power of self-organization and mutual aid.
Exactly. When the system marginalizes you, you create your own systems.
Becker's analysis here really reveals how deeply intertwined these historical systems of control, particularly those related to race and gender, continue to manifest in contemporary healthcare practices.
Right. It's not ancient history.
Not at all. The persistence of this eugenics logic, from those historical forced sterilizations right up to modern restrictions on reproductive and gender-affirming care, underscores that these aren't isolated issues. They're presented as symptoms of a pervasive ideology.
Yeah.
It really compels us to ask, where do the boundaries of individual bodily autonomy truly lie when these systemic ideologies are so profoundly at play, actively shaping medical perceptions and access?
That's the fundamental question, isn't it?
It seems to be. And that concept of the rowdy patient offers such a powerful counter-narrative. It's about agency and community resilience, demonstrating that when formal systems fail or are even hostile, these informal networks can emerge to reclaim knowledge and provide care. It's a form of pushing back against the very structures that seek to control bodies.
So it's about reclaiming medical knowledge and community care when the official system is failing or actively hostile. That's actually quite empowering in a way.
Okay, continuing our discussion on reproductive health, we turn to an international comparison. This is from Cecilia Noel in her Dispatches piece titled Sweden's Abortion Lessons.
Sweden? Okay, what can we learn from them, according to this article?
The core finding here is that Sweden demonstrates how abortion pills medication abortion can significantly expand access to care, even for later stages of pregnancy. And it provides a potential model for the United States.
Expanding access using medication abortion. How does it work there? Well, the Swedish model, as described, is quite striking. The piece profiles a midwife, Sandra Wallace, at Östra Hospital in Gothenburg. She oversees medication abortion care that is available through much of the second trimester, specifically up to 22 weeks gestation.
Up to 22 weeks with medication, that's later than often discussed in the U.S. context.
It is, and critically, the article emphasizes, it is midwives who dispense the pills and monitor patients throughout the process. This doesn't require providers with specialized surgical training.
Ah, so that broadens the pool of providers significantly.
Exactly. It allows for safe expansion of access, even into more rural regions where surgical specialists might be scarce.
Makes sense.
And the statistics are telling. Medication abortions account for a staggering 97% of all abortions in Sweden.
97%. Wow. What's the comparison figure for the U.S. mention?
Just 63% in the U.S., so a very different approach and level of integration into mainstream care.
That's a massive difference. Why the disparity, according to the piece?
Well, the article contrasts this with the U.S. system. U.S. advocates are raising awareness of medication abortion safety amidst attacks, but few realize the pills are safely used later in pregnancy elsewhere.
Right.
A key point comes from Christina Castell of the Swedish Association for Sexuality Education. She notes the U.S.'s private care system makes surgical abortions much more lucrative.
Ah, the profit motive.
That's the suggestion. Sweden's universal healthcare system, the article states, has less focus on profit, allowing abortion to be integrated into mainstream healthcare without needing patients to travel to specialists.
So the system structure itself influences the methods used and access.
That seems to be the core argument. The piece does note the importance of choice. A second trimester medication abortion is described as a mix of having a miscarriage and a delivery, varying in duration, and not every patient might prefer it. An expert from Planned Parenthood encourages maintaining both options.
Sure, patient choice is key.
But the potential for expanded access via medication is the focus.
This article provides such a stark contrast, doesn't it? It really highlights how differing healthcare system models directly influence not only access to care, but also patient choice and the integration of medical procedures.
Yeah, the system design matters immensely.
The Swedish example really presses the question of whether a profit-driven healthcare system like the one in the U.S. can truly prioritize comprehensive patient care, especially in politically contentious areas like abortion.
Right.
The fact that surgical abortions are cited as being more lucrative in the U.S. system suggests a deep-seated structural issue. It implies that financial incentives might inadvertently restrict access to more widely available and often less invasive methods.
So it's not just politics driving restrictions.
Not solely, according to this perspective. It strongly implies that policy restrictions and provider scarcity in the U.S. might not just be about political ideology, but could also be symptoms of a deeper structural problem within its market-driven healthcare framework.
It sounds like the U.S. system has built-in incentives that actually hinder broader access in some cases. Fascinating and quite troubling how a structural difference can have such profound human consequences. Okay, our next deep dive takes us into a deeply personal account of displacement and the enduring trauma of statelessness. This focuses on Palestinians who have escaped Gaza. It's Mohammed R. Malwish's feature, titled Torn Apart.
This sounds like it will be difficult but important reading.
It is. The core theme is a firsthand narrative of the psychological and legal limbo faced by Palestinians who flee Gaza. They're caught between the horrors of their homeland and the immense precarity of exile, with the condition of statelessness following them everywhere.
That idea of statelessness following you, powerful.
Very. The author provides a poignant personal experience of exile. He describes himself in a dim immigration office in Cairo, feeling reduced to a handful of papers, like he's lost his identity.
Dehumanizing.
Absolutely. And the disorienting normalcy of bureaucracy is starkly juxtaposed with a phone notification that reads, "Breaking, another airstrike in Gaza City."
Oh, wow. That contrast.
Yeah. He describes a quiet, precise, ever-present kind of grief shared with other Gazans in the waiting room, and the profound guilt he feels that his son's safety comes at the cost of someone else's child.
The psychological toll must be immense.
Immense. He talks about feeling trapped in a limbo between a life I fled and another I haven't yet begun, learning to live in two places at once and belong fully to neither.
That captures the feeling of displacement so well. What about the practical challenges?
They are multifaceted. No clear path to legal status, ever-shifting requirements like needing proof of employment for a visa, but being unable to work without one.
A catch-22.
Exactly. In Egypt, residency is temporary and fragile. In Lebanon, Jordan, and Egypt, Palestinians are often barred by law or practiced from dozens of professions. This forces highly educated professionals into precarious or informal work, making them vulnerable to exploitation.
So even skilled people can't use their skills.
Often not legally, no. Cultural differences also compound the displacement. And there are widespread mental health struggles. Anxiety, depression, a profound sense of loss.
It sounds utterly draining. Is there any discussion of resistance or maintaining culture?
Yes, definitely. The piece talks about fighting cultural erasure. Zainab in Cairo organizes poetry readings to keep telling these stories.
Mm-hmm.
Mohammed Rabi, a journalist in Turkey, struggles with Western editors who frame us as either victims or militants, nothing in between.
The danger of stereotypes.
Right. And the author tries to give his son a sense of home through photos, stories, lullabies. There's also grassroots solidarity, Palestinians building informal systems of support that governments refuse to provide, like legal aid or digital platforms to amplify Gaza stories.
Preserving the spirit in exile.
That's the phrase used. Through festivals, protests, storytelling.
This piece raises such a critical question about the long-term human cost of conflict and statelessness. It moves far beyond just immediate survival to the enduring psychological, cultural, and identity impacts of forced displacement. The article powerfully illustrates how the lack of a legal home or even a clear pathway to status creates this perpetual state of invisibility and precarity.
It denies people a future, in a way.
Fundamentally. It denies individuals the ability to truly rebuild and thrive. It underscores how political decisions and international agreements, or critically, the lack thereof, deeply shape individual lives and community resilience.
Yeah.
It truly shows the profound difference between merely surviving, which is described here as a state of constant vulnerability, and truly living, which requires a sense of belonging, security, and a future. The resilience described in the face of such systemic dehumanization is truly remarkable, but also just heartbreaking.
It's a stark reminder that even when the bombs stop falling, the impact of conflict, the displacement, continues for generations. It doesn't just end. Our next deep dive reveals a hidden and frankly cruel world where healthcare and immigration intersect. It leads to what the article calls medical deportations.
Medical deportations? What does that mean exactly?
This feature is by Lizzie Cruz, titled, When Hospitals Do ICE's Dirty Work. The core investigation is how hospitals, often seeking to limit their costs, pressure undocumented patients and their families into these medical deportations, essentially transfers back to their home countries, often when they're still very ill.
Hospitals pressuring families to deport sick relatives.
That's the allegation investigated here. And the practice, the article explains, has been significantly exacerbated by recent changes under the Trump administration.
Okay, what's the systemic flaw that allows this?
Well, it's dark. Federal law, EMTALA, requires emergency rooms to provide stabilizing, life-saving care regardless of immigration status or insurance.
Right, they have to treat emergencies.
Yes. However, hospitals are primarily driven, financially, to discharge patients as soon as they are considered stable, especially those without health insurance who represent a cost. And crucially, the article notes, hospitals are getting more comfortable with threatening medical deportation under the Trump administration. This is linked to the administration lifting federal restrictions that discouraged arrests in sensitive areas, like medical facilities.
Ah, so the threat of ICE showing up at the hospital becomes more real?
Exactly. It creates this terrifying vulnerability for undocumented patients and their families. The article uses illustrative cases.
Like what?
The story of Junior and Soledad is heartbreaking. Soledad suffered a cerebral aneurysm and was in a coma. Lehigh Valley Hospital allegedly gave her husband, Junior, three grim options. Pay $500 a day for home care they couldn't afford, find another facility, which is incredibly difficult, or agree to transfer her back to the Dominican Republic.
Which Junior feared would mean her death.
Precisely. Another case involved AV, a Guatemalan man left in a vegetative state. Jefferson Torresdale Hospital allegedly lied about his wife's consent for transfer and threatened to literally drop him off at your doorstep if his niece didn't sign for his removal.
That's coercion, plain and simple.
Sounds like it. The piece also mentions a former Fulbright scholar, John Sullivan, who tracks similar cases, highlighting how this practice shifts the burden of care onto families with few resources, in countries often ill-equipped to handle complex medical needs.
Is there any resistance described or policy changes?
Yes. AV's story gained public attention after medical students circulated a petition, first, do no harm, and the Free Migration Project organized a protest. This ultimately prevented his immediate deportation.
Public pressure worked.
In that case, yes. He was eventually discharged to a nursing home and later consented to transfer only after his health improved significantly. And Pennsylvania passed a law protecting patients, allowing fines for hospitals and giving patients the right to sue.
So some progress at the state level.
Some. But the article warns the situation is precarious nationally. Trump threatens to penalize states offering health insurance to undocumented immigrants by reducing federal Medicaid funds. And ICE officials are slated to gain access to personal data of 79 million Medicaid enrollees to track down undocumented immigrants.
That access to data is chilling.
It is. Even California's Governor Newsom proposed freezing medical enrollment for undocumented adults, which advocates fear will increase deportations. And Junior himself experienced threats from the nursing home about his wife not being good for their business.
The story raises such a crucial question about the ethical responsibilities of healthcare institutions when they're faced with these financial pressures and shifting, often hostile, immigration policies.
Absolutely. Where does the bottom line end and ethics begin?
The core dilemma here is whether the pursuit of cost-saving measures can ever justify what amounts to denying basic human dignity and access to necessary, sometimes life-sustaining, care.
Yeah.
This article reveals a deeply troubling vulnerability within the social safety net, where even life-saving care can become a leverage point for deportation. It highlights how individual agency and the well-being of already vulnerable populations are systematically undermined by opaque administrative rules and the increasing politicization of healthcare itself.
It's truly a stark reminder that even fundamental human rights can be compromised for economic or political expediency. The idea that healthcare, of all things, can be weaponized against the vulnerable is just deeply chilling. Okay, we now turn to a pivotal figure in contemporary New York politics, Zohran Mamdani. We mentioned him earlier. His recent mayoral primary victory offers, potentially, a new path for the Democratic Party.
Right, building on the Ackerman piece. What's the focus here?
This is a detailed interview with Mamdani himself, conducted by Katrina Vandenheuvel and John Nichols. It's titled, Zohran Mamdani's New York. The core focus is really exploring his governing philosophy, his laser-like focus on affordability, his unique approach to politics and media, and his overall vision for New York City and maybe beyond.
Okay, getting inside his thinking.
Exactly. So the basics. Mamdani, 33 years old, Ugandan-born state legislator from Queens, won the Democratic mayoral primary with the most votes ever for a primary winner.
Most votes ever. That's significant.
Very. And he could be the city's first Muslim mayor, another major historical milestone. His laser-like focus on affordability issues is presented in the piece as offering a clear path forward for a Democratic Party that's seen as desperate for momentum nationally.
So a potential model.
That's the framing. His style is described as accessible, enthusiastic, and joyful determination, which is contrasted sharply with Donald Trump's dark vision. And notably, he secured endorsements from powerful unions like 1199 SEOU, despite maybe having some initial distance from national Democratic figures like Chuck Schumer and Hakeem Jeffries.
Interesting coalition building there. What about his governing philosophy? Where does he draw inspiration?
He's inspired by figures like Franklin Delano Roosevelt, FDR, and Fiorello LaGuardia, NYC's famous mayor.
LaGuardia, okay, the little flower.
Exactly. He quotes FDR saying democracy must have a resonance to the needs of working people's lives to survive. It's under attack not just from authoritarianism, he argues, but from the withering of the belief in its ability to deliver.
The ability to deliver. That's key.
Right. And he sees parallels with LaGuardia fighting anti-immigrant animus and understanding democracy's fruition as more parks, more beauty, more light. Mamdani vows to deliver on concrete promises. Freeze rent. Make the slowest buses fast and free. Deliver universal childcare.
Ambitious goals. How does he plan to achieve them?
He emphasizes hiring the best, the brightest, and also the hungriest. People aligned with convictions. Politically, he says Democrats have been embarrassed by some of our convictions, but New Yorkers value trust over perfect agreement. He runs an unabashed campaign, transparent about fiscal policy, even with CEOs like matching NY's corporate tax rate to New Jersey's, increasing taxes on the top 1%.
So not shying away from progressive policies.
Not at all. He rejects mimicking Republicans, showcases an alternative vision based on sincerity, and connects with former rivals, seeking to expand his coalition. Extend your hand, not settle scores.
Pragmatic coalition building alongside strong principles. What about dealing with Trump?
He talks about Trump-proofing NYC by raising revenue to protect against federal cuts, enforcing sanctuary city policies, and instilling hope. He dismisses Trump's personal attacks as distractions from Trump's own betrayal of working-class people.
Okay. And how does he define his democratic socialism?
He cites Martin Luther King Jr., call it democracy or call it democratic socialism, but there must be a better distribution of wealth. For city government, it means ensuring every New Yorker lives a dignified life, like LaGuardia's public works. He's also inspired by Milwaukee's sewer socialists, who focused on improving public services and quality of life. The worth of an ideology can only be judged by its delivery, he says.
Delivery again. Does he engage with the business community?
Yes, he sees them as part of the city, despite fiscal disagreements. He wants to correct the caricature created by attack ads and discuss shared interests like parks and streetscapes. He also emphasizes retrieving lost traditions like free city universities, and the necessity of politics happening in public.
And his media strategy. He's known for being active online.
Yeah, he engages both traditional and social media, recognizing over half of Americans use social media for news. He says he'll continue using it as mayor to ensure New Yorkers hear from those whom they have elected through a medium that they actually use.
Interesting. Direct communication.
Exactly. He takes inspiration from Sanders, Ocasio-Cortez, Claudia Sheinbaum. As a potential first immigrant mayor in generations, his focus is local, but with potential lessons for elsewhere.
Mamdani's approach here offers a really fascinating blueprint, possibly, for political strategy in this highly polarized environment we're in.
How so?
Well, he seems to be combining these, you know, unabashed progressive principles with very pragmatic coalition building and direct communication. He's demonstrating how to fight for a clear vision without necessarily alienating potential allies by focusing on tangible, immediate improvements in people's daily lives, rather than maybe solely on ideological purity. This suggests that political success in deeply divided times might depend less on mirroring the opponent or abstract ideals and more on demonstrating consistent, measurable results in people's lives. A return to a form of, you could call it, delivery politics.
Delivery politics. I like that.
His ability to bridge different segments of the electorate, from union members to, as the article notes, winning 20% of New York's Jewish voters, despite smears, by emphasizing that economic common ground is a significant departure from typical contemporary political campaigning. It could indeed serve as a powerful model.
So it's about showing up and delivering, not just talking the talk. It sounds like a very practical approach to progressive politics, grounded in results.
Okay.
Okay, amidst all these discussions of grand political movements and, you know, systemic challenges, our next piece provides a powerful counter-narrative. It urges us to consider the often overlooked power of individual action.
Okay, a different scale.
Exactly. This is Eli Mistel's column, Objection. The core argument here is that while large-scale resistance might feel futile sometimes.
A feeling many can probably relate to.
I think so. The article champions the value of small, individual acts of noncompliance as essential tools. Tools to slow, frustrate, or sabotage our government's efforts, or simply to help another person.
So resistance doesn't have to be a mass protest.
Not exclusively, Mistel argues. He directly acknowledges the feeling of futility, stating that despair is a legitimate and even rational response to the perceived victory of, as he puts it, white supremacy, bigotry, and hostile billionaire takeover.
He doesn't dismiss the despair.
No, he validates it. However, he argues strongly against giving in to this despair or inaction. He rejects the notion that individual efforts are useless simply because large-scale political systems seem insurmountable.
Okay, so what examples does he offer?
He gives historical examples of heroism. Ida B. Wells, who didn't just cancel subscriptions to racist newspapers, she bought her own newspapers to report on lynchings.
Wow. Direct action.
Yeah. Or Oskar Schindler, famously an actual Nazi Party member, who saved countless lives through his individual efforts within a monstrous system.
Right. Working from the inside.
He also mentions others. People joining drug dealers to hand out clean needles during the AIDS epidemic, soldiers refusing malicious orders, citizens shuttling people for abortion services despite bounty hunting laws.
Everyday people taking risks.
Exactly. And there's a particularly poignant anecdote of a B-17 pilot whose plane was hit multiple times, but the shells had no explosive charge. Inside one was a note. This is all we can do for you now.
Oh my goodness. That's incredible. An act of sabotage from within the war machine.
A small act with huge consequences. Mistel also notes, perhaps controversially, that the bad guys, as he calls them, the white wing movement, have been operating this way for years, using whatever it is they can do, big or small, individually or collectively, to bring about more suffering. They don't despair, they get angry, and use what power they have maximally.
So learn from the opponent's tactics, in a way.
That seems to be part of the implication. The call action is clear. Don't give in to despair. Every life saved, every person helped, is a victory. He posits a different game. Not about winning or losing, but helping or not helping. And concludes with that resonant phrase, that is all we can do for now.
This piece offers such a powerful reframing of power and impact, especially in times when the odds feel overwhelming.
Yeah, it shifts the focus.
Mistel deliberately counters that pervasive feeling of helplessness by arguing that resistance isn't solely about grand public gestures or direct political wins. It's also about a continuous, personalized refusal to comply with injustice and a commitment to human solidarity.
Decentralized resistance.
Exactly. It suggests that true resistance involves this decentralized, multifaceted approach where individual moral courage, expressed in seemingly small acts, can cumulatively contribute to larger societal shifts, even when the overall political battle seems unwinnable. It compels us to ask, how do we define victory in oppressive times? And how can preserving dignity and providing aid be considered victories in themselves, regardless of the larger political outcome?
It's a reminder that even when the overall fight seems impossible, every individual act of kindness or defiance still matters. It has its own intrinsic value. All right, our deep dive into the September 2025 issue now brings us to a critical analysis of current geopolitical tensions. This one draws parallels to a very fraught historical period.
Okay, where are we heading now?
This is Jeet Heer's column, titled Morbid Symptoms. The core argument here is quite sobering. Heer argues that despite the intense polarization we see within the United States on almost every issue.
Right, the deep divisions.
The U.S. political elite is remarkably united on one thing. A great power competition against China. Heer argues that this push for a new Cold War is driven by, in his words, fantasies of national unity, and dangerously echoes the disastrous first Cold War.
A new Cold War driven by fantasies of unity. That's a provocative take. Is this consensus really that strong?
Heer presents it as a rare uniting force for both Democrats and Republicans. He quotes figures like Steve Bannon saying, "The thing that pulls it together is China." And even Joe Biden asserting that winning the competition with China should unite all of us.
So bipartisan agreement on this specific foreign policy stance.
That's the assertion. And this bipartisan alignment, Heer suggests, serves a domestic political purpose. It papers over deep internal divisions by focusing attention and resources on an external threat.
Using foreign policy to manage domestic conflict. A classic pattern, perhaps.
Heer certainly thinks so. Mm-hmm. He then draws crucial lessons from the first Cold War, the one spanning the mid-20th century. He unequivocally labels it a disaster.
A disaster? How so?
He points to the grim statistics. 20 million dead in proxy wars fall across the globe.
20 million.
And intense domestic repression under McCarthyism within the U.S. itself. He also mentions military Keynesianism, increasing economic inequality, and civil rights activists being under siege by a surveillance state. So huge external and internal costs.
Not a rosy picture of the first Cold War at all. What dangers does Heer see in this new Cold War?
Several major ones. He argues it has already fueled domestic repression and increased the risk of foreign wars. Critically, he says it delays efforts to tackle the genuine existential threat of climate change, potentially making that crisis truly apocalyptic.
Distraction from climate change, that's a huge potential cost.
Massive. He also argues it gives a license to xenophobia, exemplified by Trump blaming China for everything from fentanyl to COVID and the ferocious purge of Chinese students he launched in 2020.
And is this xenophobia seen as exclusively on one side?
No, Heer points out it's not exclusive to the GOP. He cites an instance where Nancy Pelosi told Code Pink protesters to go back to China where your headquarters is.
So bipartisan xenophobia fueled by this consensus.
That's the concern raised. The policy shift itself, Heer notes, began under Obama's administration with a return to great power competition declared in 2016 and was then intensified by both Trump and Biden. A representative, Stephanie Murphy, is quoted noting how this consensus pushes towards politics rather than smart policy.
This column really raises an important question about the unintended consequences of bipartisan consensus, doesn't it?
It certainly does.
Particularly when that consensus is built on a perceived external threat and perhaps a desire for domestic unity above all else. The article cautions strongly against repeating that historical pattern of using external conflicts to paper over internal divisions.
Because the costs are too high.
Exactly. Heer argues that such strategies have devastating domestic and global costs and can dangerously distract from genuine existential threats like climate change. It directly challenges the notion that having a common enemy inherently makes a nation somehow its best self, as some proponents might argue. Instead, it suggests that unity founded on an adversarial foreign policy can ironically lead to greater internal repression, increased global instability, and a critical neglect of urgent domestic and planetary challenges.
It's a powerful argument. that what appears to unite us externally can actually end up undermining us internally and globally in profound ways. Okay, following that discussion of geopolitical strategies, we turn to a powerful statement from Iranian women themselves. This piece challenges the narratives often imposed by foreign powers.
Okay, voices from the ground. What's the piece?
This is Dua Izzara Shah's Not in Our Names, presented as a Nation Voices piece. The core assertion made by Iranian women involved in the Woman Life Freedom Movement is explicit and unambiguous.
Which is?
They reject claims by Israel and the United States that recent military attacks on Iran somehow benefit them or their movement. Instead, they state very clearly that foreign intervention has, in fact, set their movement back and actually intensified its repression by the regime.
Wow. So the opposite effect of what might be claimed or intended by those external powers.
Exactly. The article highlights the unsettling co-optation of their powerful slogan, Woman, Life, Freedom, or ZAN, Zindagi, Azadi, which originated in the Kurdish women's movement and spread globally after Jina Mahsa Amini's death in 2022.
Right. That slogan became internationally known.
It did. And Benjamin Netanyahu's invocation of that very slogan after Israeli airstrikes on Iran is seen by these women as a jarring attempt to package woman, life, freedom from the perspective of a nation state or patriarchal power or geopolitical games.
Co-opting a liberation slogan for state purposes?
Precisely. When, as one activist puts it, its very core is about humanity and liberation for all, not about nation states or geopolitical maneuvering.
What were the impacts of the strikes described in the piece?
Devastating. The article states the Israeli attacks killed hundreds of people, including women, and caused widespread destruction and economic hardship. This forced the movement, which was focused on rights and freedoms, to shift its focus back to just basic survival.
Survival mode pushes activism aside.
It seems to. And the Islamic Republic reportedly intensified repression in response, targeting activists and social media users, pushing vague new criminal laws that could lead to the death penalty for civic or even social media activity.
Intensified repression. So the strikes backfired on the movement itself.
According to these voices, yes. The attack on Evin Prison, which killed 71 people, is highlighted not as a military target, but potentially as a deliberate attempt to silence dissidents, including those who oppose figures like Reza Pahlavi, the exiled son of Iran's last Shah, who is noted as being close to Israeli officials.
So targeting internal dissent under the cover of external conflict.
That's a possible interpretation raised. And the women reject false binaries. Imprisoned activists smuggled out a statement condemning the strike, saying, "Our liberation is only possible through mass struggle, not by placing our hopes in foreign powers."
A powerful statement from prison.
Indeed. Many emphasize, being anti-regime doesn't mean being pro-imperialist. Niko Nuriani points out how the war has worsened inflation and unemployment, already rampant due to international sanctions, and believes Western countries need to lift sanctions for Iranians to pursue democratic change on their own terms.
So sanctions are also seen as counterproductive to democratic change by some.
By this activist, yes. But despite setbacks, the movement's achievements are seen as deeply rooted. It's entering a new phase, sharpening its critique of all forms of domination, authoritarian, colonial, nationalist, and imperialist. Anti-war discourses are more prominent, with a focus on transnational alliances grounded in feminist ethics.
Resilience and evolution of the movement's thinking.
Exactly. There are examples of community solidarity people offering free accommodation, tea at gas lines, building communication networks during blackouts. The spirit of resistance is carried across generations.
This piece provides such a crucial counter-narrative to the often simplified stories told by foreign powers, doesn't it?
It really does.
It illustrates how foreign military actions, even if ostensibly framed as being for liberation or human rights, can inadvertently strengthen authoritarian regimes, displace genuine grassroots movements, and force populations back into basic survival mode.
Undermining the very people they claim to help.
Potentially, yes. It strongly demonstrates the absolute necessity of listening to the voices of those directly affected by conflict and intervention rather than imposing external solutions or narratives.
Yeah.
It also highlights how truly transformative movements like Woman, Life, Freedom are often deeply rooted in local experiences and gain strength through internal solidarity, a solidarity which external forces can inadvertently disrupt rather than aid. It really makes you question who truly benefits from these kinds of external interventions.
The idea that external help can actually hurt a movement's cause is such a vital lesson, and one that seems frequently overlooked in international relations. All right, our deep dive continues now with a journey across the United States. We're exploring the past, the present, and the, well, precarious future of American train travel.
Ah, Amtrak. Okay.
Exactly. This is Julian Epp's feature, titled End of the Line. The core observation here is that Amtrak, our national rail service, really reflects a broader American story, a story of expansion, exploitation, disinvestment, and decay. It's struggling to remain relevant against both historical and contemporary challenges.
Disinvestment and decay. That sounds familiar for U.S. infrastructure.
It does. The article starkly contrasts the, you know, lack of fanfare from modern Amtrak departures with the celebratory atmosphere surrounding America's first steam locomotive back in 1830. Apparently, there were cannons, flowers, and a band as it reached a breakneck speed of 25 miles per hour.
Hey, 25 miles per hour, breakneck. Times change.
They certainly do. Today, the article notes flying is typically half the cost of the train, and obviously much faster. NYC to LA is 6 hours by plane versus days by train.
So it's mostly for shorter routes now?
Primarily, yes. Amtrak is mostly known for short Northeast corridor trips, carrying three times more passengers between Washington, D.C. and New York City than all the airlines combined on that route. That highlights its limited scope compared to its potential for longer journeys.
Right. Still dominant on that specific corridor. What are the systemic challenges highlighted?
A big one stems from its creation. The Grand Bargain with Richard Nixon in 1970 created Amtrak, essentially freeing private rail companies from their passenger service obligations. It was a deal intended, according to critics cited, to get passenger service off the backs of the railroads and eventually put an end to passenger trains.
So set up to fail, almost.
That's the argument presented by some. A huge ongoing issue is that Amtrak is forced to share 95% of its route network with freight trains, which legally own the tracks and often hinder passenger service.
Wow, the freight interference problem.
Exactly. There's an example of Norfolk Southern being sued for hindering Amtrak's Crescent Line, which had only a 24% on-time rate in 2023. Federal law technically gives passenger trains preference, but it's rarely enforced effectively.
So they're often stuck waiting for freight.
Frequently. And then there's aging equipment. Many of the double-decker superliners used on long-distance routes date back to 1979. They're over 40 years old, nearing the end of their life. A new fleet is promised, but not until the early 2030s.
Decades-old equipment. That points to the disinvestment theme.
It really does. And political disinvestment is a major focus. President George W. Bush threatened to eliminate federal funding entirely. Donald Trump called for slashing Amtrak's budget by half in his first term, leading to management job cuts. Trump also canceled $4 billion in federal funds for California's high-speed rail project.
So, active hostility from some administrations. What about Biden? He's known as Amtrak Joe.
Right. Biden signed the Infrastructure and Jobs Act, providing billions, which was a boost. But the article argues that progress has been erased under the subsequent Trump administration's policies and proposed cuts.
A back-and-forth battle for funding. Despite all this, is there anything positive about the passenger experience?
The article does capture the unique sea-level perspective. Train travel offers a different view of the nation. And despite the challenges, people do still care about rail. It mentions 25 million Americans with aerophobia rely on trains.
A captive audience, in a way.
Yeah. And there are train fanatics, like a passenger named Gary profiled, who simply prefer the immersive experience. Mm. You don't realize how big the country is until you cross it by train, he says.
There is something romantic about train travel still.
There is, and there's resilience. A 2018 proposal to replace a segment of the Southwest Chief Route with an 11-hour bus trip sparked furious resistance from legislators and constituents, forcing funds to be released.
So grassroots support can make a difference.
Sometimes, yes. The piece ends with the author missing a rerouted flight due to storms, seeing train tracks, and thinking, I should have taken the train.
A familiar feeling for air travelers sometimes. You know, the story of Amtrak really isn't just about trains, is it?
No, it feels much bigger.
It feels like a microcosm of America's choices regarding public versus private interests and how a nation can neglect foundational services that once symbolized its aspirations.
Right.
That grand bargain with Nixon in 1970, which created Amtrak supposedly to free private rail companies from passenger service, effectively seems to have kneecapped the system from its inception by prioritizing freight over passengers. This decision, the article highlights, reflects a deliberate policy choice with long-lasting consequences.
A choice to prioritize private freight profit over public passenger service.
Essentially. And this neglect ultimately impacts both national unity by hindering connection across vast regions and the daily lives of citizens by limiting affordable, accessible, and arguably more sustainable travel options. It's a really compelling illustration of how short-sighted policy decisions can cripple vital public infrastructure over decades.
It really makes you wonder what America would look like today if that bargain had never been struck, or if our rail system had been invested in consistently, like in many other developed nations. A different kind of connection, perhaps. Okay, we shift now to a profound exploration of a core American concept, freedom. Our next deep dive is penned by the renowned historian Eric Foner.
Ah, Foner! A heavyweight on this topic.
Indeed. His piece is titled The Education of a Historian, and it reminds us that freedom is not some static, unchanging ideal.
Okay, so how does he define it?
Well, the core argument Foner makes is that freedom is neither a fixed idea nor the story of progress toward a predetermined goal. Instead, he argues, it's an evolving concept, constantly shaped by debates and struggles throughout American history. And it often reflects deeply contrasting interpretations depending on who you ask and when.
Not fixed, but contested. Always contested.
Exactly. Foner grounds this argument in both personal and historical context. He recounts his own family's experience during the Rapp-Kudrid Committee's purge of alleged subversives from CONY in the 1940s. His father and uncles lost teaching jobs, highlighting for him the fragility of civil liberties.
A personal connection to the suppression of ideas.
Right. And his extensive scholarly work on the Reconstruction era revealed radically different ideas of freedom held simultaneously by former slave owners, formerly enslaved African Americans, and Northerners right after the Civil War.
Three completely different definitions of freedom operating at the same time.
Precisely. It underscores the contested nature of the concept from the nation's earliest, most formative moments. To help us understand this better, Foner draws on Isaiah Berlin's famous 1958 essay, distinguishing between two key concepts of liberty.
Okay, what are they?
Negative liberty, which is freedom from interference, the absence of outside restraints on individual action. Here, government is often seen as a potential threat to freedom.
Freedom from government, okay.
And positive liberty, which is freedom to act, freedom as empowerment, the ability to establish and achieve one's goals. This often requires government action to remove barriers, like poverty or discrimination, that prevent people from being truly free.
Freedom through government action, potentially. Got it.
Yeah.
How does he see this playing out in politics?
He traces how presidents have used the word freedom.
Yeah.
FDR linked freedom to economic security for ordinary Americans, assuming an active government role, positive liberty.
Right, the New Deal vision.
Then Reagan redefined freedom primarily as limited government, low taxes, and unregulated economic enterprise, negative liberty.
The Reagan Revolution framing.
Exactly. In the 2024 election, he notes, Kamala Harris and the Democrats tried to reclaim the word, emphasizing reproductive freedom after the overturning of Roe v. Wade. George W. Bush used freedom constantly, 49 times in his second inaugural alone, as an all-purpose justification for the Iraq invasion, Operation Iraqi Freedom.
Using freedom for foreign intervention.
Obama and Trump, Foner notes, use the word freedom less, preferring terms like community, equality, and personal responsibility, Obama, or emphasizing raw military and economic power, Trump.
So the language itself shifts with the political winds.
Constantly. And this connects to the contested nature of history itself. Foner quotes Carl Becker. History is what the present chooses to remember about the past.
History is a reflection of the present.
Yes. He points to recently enacted state laws barring the teaching of controversial or disturbing ideas, which mandate a celebratory American history, one that gives short shrift to the less than praiseworthy realities.
Whitewashing history.
That's the concern. This reinforces polarization, with each side embracing its own preferred concept of America and its history. He gives examples like the Daughters of the Confederacy demanding textbooks not present slavery as benign, or the McCarthy era, removing disloyal historians' works from libraries. Remembering history accurately when others distort it, Foner concludes, is itself a form of resistance.
This analysis really raises an important question about how our national narratives are constructed and contested, doesn't it? Especially around a concept as fundamental and as malleable as freedom.
Absolutely. It's constantly being defined and redefined.
Foner's distinction between negative and positive liberty provides such a crucial analytical lens for understanding the enduring philosophical and political battles that shape America. It highlights how historical memory isn't just about the past.
No, it's active.
It's actively a battleground for defining present identity and future direction. It's often weaponized in political discourse. The ongoing efforts to control historical narratives, like those state laws Foner mentions, demonstrate that the fight over the meaning of freedom is as much about who gets to tell the story of America as it is about any current policy debate.
Yeah.
It makes you think about whose version of history, whose definition of freedom we are implicitly endorsing by simply not questioning the narratives we're presented with.
So understanding history, the real history, isn't just about knowing facts. Foner presents it as almost an act of resistance against those who would narrow our understanding of freedom and the American story itself.
Okay, building directly on that idea of contested history and its echoes, we turn to a review by David Cole. It's titled The War at Home, Red Scares in the American Past and Present. And it finds some startling echoes of America's past Red Scares in our current political landscape.
Red Scares. So McCarthyism and before, how does it connect to today? Well, the core argument of Cole's review, he's reviewing a book by Clay Risen called Red Scare, is that while the historian Risen deliberately avoids making direct analogies.
Okay, the historian is cautious.
Yes, but Cole, the reviewer, argues the parallels between mid-20th century McCarthyism and the current political climate under what he calls Trump 2.0 are simply too stark to ignore. He sees it illustrating how populist scapegoating can take hold of a nation.
Populist scapegoating? What were the historical Red Scares like, according to the review?
Cole details them briefly. The first Red Scare after World War I featured the Palmer Raids, rounding up and deporting thousands of foreign nationals just for suspected associations.
Guilt by association.
Pretty much. Then the second Red Scare, McCarthyism, after World War II, that involved Truman's loyalty program screening nearly 5 million federal employees. Hundreds were fired. Thousands resigned. All for undefined disloyalty.
5 million screened. The scale is enormous.
Huge. There was a list of subversive organizations, hundreds of them, including groups like the National Lawyers Guild. Just being associated could cost you your job. And it wasn't just federal. Local examples are cited. Chicago barred suspected communists from public housing. New York State denied fishing licenses. NYC fired high school math teachers. It permeated society.
Wow. Fishing licenses denied. It reached everywhere. So what are the parallels Cole draws to today?
He points to the origins. Risen, the book's author, attributes the original Red Scare partly to a backlash against the New Deal, which ushered in a more egalitarian, diverse, tolerant America. This backlash was fueled by fear of the Soviet Union, yes, but also by resentment from those who felt forgotten, like the small-town middle class, fundamentalist white supremacists by this changing America run by a perceived detached elite.
Backlash against social change and blaming elites. Sounds familiar.
Cole certainly thinks so. He asserts the right is still fighting the New Deal, using a very similar strategy of stoking grievances and blaming elites and migrants. He notes Trump supporters seem untroubled by the idea of tearing down federal infrastructure.
What about tactics?
Cole sees parallels in the use of executive power. The Supreme Court showing deep skepticism about the administrative state and insisting on unchecked authority for the president reminds him of unchecked power during McCarthyism. Trump suppressing evidence or research that contradicts his ideology on healthcare, climate change, also echoes past behavior.
And the politicians themselves.
Both periods, Cole argues, saw politicians McCarthy then, Trump now with no respect for fundamental norms, willing to lie brazenly and adept at exploiting dissatisfaction. Though he characterizes Trump's administration more like an organized crime gang than a meticulously organized security state, like during the Cold War.
Interesting distinction. Does Cole see any differences in scale or resistance?
Yes, significant ones. McCarthyism lasted over a decade, permeated every aspect of public and private life, affecting millions directly. Trump's initiatives, Cole argues, apart from the big, beautiful bill targeting immigrants, have been largely limited to unilateral executive orders and actions so far.
And the courts.
Crucially, courts during the Red Scare did nothing to stop McCarthyism, often affirming dubious convictions. In contrast, Cole notes, blue state attorneys general have challenged many of Trump's initiatives in federal court, resulting in more than 200 rulings against the administration thus far.
So institutional pushback is stronger now, at least from the courts in some states.
That's a key difference highlighted. Also, compliance versus resistance. The Red Scare was a public-private partnership. McCarthy relied on private institutions, studios, universities, to fire and blacklist people. An entire industry parasitic on anti-communism emerged. Many people cooperated out of fear or self-interest.
The Hollywood blacklist, for example.
Exactly. Even labor unions were often complicit. Today, Cole sees a mixed picture. Some law firms and universities capitulate to pressure, while others, he names Perkins Coie, Harvard, courageously fight back. He implies history will judge those who stood on principle positively.
So, more resistance in some quarters today. Does Coie think it's worse now or then?
He's cautious. He quotes another historian, Ellen Schrecker, who says this is worse than McCarthyism. But Coie pushes back slightly, noting the sheer half-century span of the Cold War, the pervasive surveillance state then, the proxy wars, the millions affected. He concludes Trump's initiatives do not yet come close to matching the range and depth of McCarthyism, but adds ominously, he's only getting started.
A sobering comparison. This analysis provides a really useful, albeit chilling, framework for understanding populist movements and the erosion of democratic norms, doesn't it?
It really does.
It emphasizes the critical role of institutions, particularly the judiciary, but also the importance of individual and collective courage in resisting these kinds of tides. The contrast in judicial responses between the McCarthy era and today is particularly salient. It highlights how institutional checks and balances, when they're effectively leveraged, can provide a bulwark against executive overreach.
So institutions matter, but they need to be activated.
Precisely. And what's fascinating is how the article underscores that while the tactics of scapegoating and fear-mongering might echo across generations, the degree of their success and how deeply they penetrate into society depends significantly on the willingness of individuals and institutions to either comply or resist.
Yeah.
It really highlights the moral clarity that shines through in retrospect for those who resisted during the Red Scare, offering perhaps a crucial guide for action in present times.
The power of institutional pushback and individual conscience is a key takeaway here. It reminds us that history doesn't just repeat itself blindly. It offers lessons on how to potentially break the cycle. Okay, let's transition now to a historical figure who absolutely embodied the very spirit of American multitudes, Mark Twain.
Ah, Twain, Samuel Clemens. Can't get much more American than that.
Right. Our next deep dive explores a new biography by Ron Chernow. You know, the Hamilton biographer.
Oh, Chernow on Twain. That must be substantial.
It is. The book is simply titled Mark Twain, and it's reviewed here by Adam Hochschild in a piece called The Adventures of Samuel Clemens. The core theme is that Chernow's biography reveals Samuel Clemens's multitudinous lives. The transformative writer, the world-famous celebrity, and also the author's final years, which were marked by profound personal sorrow and some rather unusual fixations.
Multitudinous lives. That sounds about right for Twain. What contrast does the review highlight?
His life was just full of them. He went from a boy in Hannibal, Missouri, living in cramped quarters above a drugstore, to eventually becoming this world-renowned author living in an 11,500-square-foot home with 25 rooms in Hartford.
Quite the journey from poverty to wealth.
Absolutely. His early impoverished travels by stagecoach contrasted sharply with later life when he hired private railway cars. His early jobs included a brief stint in the Confederate militia, searching for gold out west, being a newspaper reporter.
A real adventurer.
Yeah. And later in life, he's recognized by the Russian Tsar, pals around with Andrew Carnegie, meets Woodrow Wilson. Just incredible reach.
What about the writer aspect?
Hochschild notes his geyser of work. 30 books, thousands of articles, voluminous autobiography. Huckleberry Finn and Life on the Mississippi are singled out as his masterworks.
Agreed. Seminal American literature. Does it delve into his views on race that's often complex with Twain?
Yes, significantly. The review highlights Twain's profound reckoning with slavery. It was influenced partly by his wife Olivia's abolitionist family, but also, crucially, by a memorable conversation he had with his sister-in-law's black cook. She recounted the horror of seeing her husband and children auctioned off.
Oh, wow. A direct personal testimony.
Yes. And this broadening of his awareness, the review suggests, directly led to the complex and human figure of Jim in Huckleberry Finn. It wasn't just abstract.
That makes sense.
And interestingly, the review mentions his own form of racial reparations. He financially supported several black individuals, including Warner T. McGuinn, one of the first black students at Yale Law School, who later mentored Thurgood Marshall.
I did not know that. That's fascinating. Paying for education is reparation.
Yeah, quite remarkable. Then there's the celebrity. Chernow apparently suggests Twain fairly invented our celebrity culture.
Invented celebrity culture? How so?
He was an insider whose fame crossed class boundaries. He was cheered by dock workers in England, but also received an honorary Oxford degree. His 70th birthday party was a huge, lavish affair. Performance was central to his work. He honed his writing and comedic timing through lectures, apparently even making the famously stoic Ulysses S. Grant laugh.
Making Grant laugh is an achievement. Did he use his celebrity for causes?
Yes, absolutely. He spoke out against injustices like King Leopold II's horrific forced labor regime in the Congo and the brutal U.S. colonial war in the Philippines. He famously said, "I am opposed to having the eagle put its talons on any other land."
A strong anti-imperialist stance, especially for that era.
Very much so. But then the review discusses the final years, which were haunting and increasingly difficult.
Ah, the darker period.
Yeah, marked by immense sorrow. He lost one child in infancy, then his beloved eldest daughter, Susie, at 24, from spinal meningitis, which caused him deep guilt. His wife, Livy, suffered declining health and died while they were in Florence. His youngest daughter, Jean, had severe epilepsy and suffered a fatal seizure.
Just waves of tragedy. Unbearable.
It sounds like it was. He also managed a quarrelsome household, accusing his secretary, Isabel Lyon, of embezzlement. And the review mentions his strange and revealing fixation on young girls. His angelfish, he called them. Age 10 to 16.
His angelfish. That sounds unsettling.
The review describes it as a chaste but obsessive need for creatures of imagined innocence. He seemed to believe Susie died at the happy age 24 years. At 24, such a girl has seen the best of life. It suggests a difficulty coping with adult womanhood, perhaps connected to his losses. He also struggled to accept his surviving daughter Clara's singing career, often undermining her.
Complex and troubled final years.
Very. Hochschild notes his early world, The Riverboat, the raft was almost entirely male, which might offer some context. And importantly, his authorized biographer, Albert Bigelow Payne, apparently sanitized Twain's legacy,
yeah,
omitting his anti-imperialist views and other critical comments.
The legacy management. Controlling the narrative after death.
Exactly.
This biography sounds fascinating. It really raises that important question about how we reconcile the public image of a revered historical figure like Twain with their complex, often contradictory private life, and how legacies themselves are constructed, sometimes deliberately sanitized.
Right. Who gets to decide what we remember?
Twain's journey, from those humble beginnings to global celebrity, and his profound engagement with the moral dilemmas of his time, especially race and empire, highlights the enduring power of narrative, but also the often painful process of confronting societal sins within a personal journey.
Yeah.
The tragic arc of his final years, marked by those deep losses and peculiar fixations, adds such complex layers to his famous public persona. It suggests that even the most celebrated figures truly contain multitudes, and that a genuine understanding of history requires grappling with these complexities rather than just accepting simplified, convenient versions. It truly makes you consider how his life, in many ways, mirrored the expansive and conflicted nature of America itself, from its grand ideals to its hidden struggles and sorrows.
He seems to represent the complicated soul of America itself, doesn't he? Both its incredible creativity and humor, and its painful contradictions and grief. Okay, our final deep dive into this September 2025 issue leads us into the world of contemporary art. Specifically, the work of Lorna Simpson, whose pieces invite us to reconsider how we interpret what we see.
Lorna Simpson, okay. A major contemporary artist. What's the focus of this review?
This is Rachel Hunter Himes' review, titled In Touch with the Galaxy. The core exploration is Simpson's career, which spans nearly four decades now across photography, collage, sculpture, painting. And the consistent thread, Himes argues, is that Simpson creates art that resists quick and easy reads. It challenges conventional ways we assign meaning to bodies and images, particularly Black female bodies.
Resists easy reads. Challenges meaning. How does she do that? Let's start with her earlier work.
Okay. The article first describes her early conceptual practice back in the 1980s and 90s. Simpson deliberately subverted traditional photography, which typically aims to make individual personhood indisputable through capturing the face, right?
Right. The portrait is usually about the face, identity.
Exactly. But Simpson's photographs often feature Black women seen from behind or cropped at the neck, deliberately obscuring their faces, the privileged locus of personhood, as Himes puts it.
Denying the viewer that easy identification. Interesting. What about the text she uses?
She often appends cryptic texts to these images, but they're not captions in the traditional sense. Instead, they conjure dominant codes of meaning, only to demonstrate their dubious applicability or inadequacy.
Can you give an example?
Sure. The piece discusses You're Fine from 1988. It shows a woman's back, framed by text listing things like body parts, bodily functions, and phrases like secretarial position, you're fine, you're hired.
Ah, connecting medical examination with employment scrutiny.
Precisely. Himes suggests that explores the depersonalization of Black women as subjects of both medical probing and employment conditions, hinting at histories of racialized medical violence, like the unanesthetized experiments on enslaved women.
Powerful historical resonance there.
Very. Another example is Dividing Lines, 1989, with side-by-side photos of a Black woman and plaques listing phrases like out of line, color line, actor's lines. It challenges viewers to make cohesive meaning, revealing the leaps we take to arrive at meaning.
Forcing the viewer to question their own interpretation process.
Exactly. And Myths, 1991, pairs images of African masks with a Black woman whose back is turned, alongside mundane conversational text fragments like Stevie Wonder writing a song. This suggests attempts to form personal identity from disparate references and experiences, specifically drawing on Black American identity construction.
Okay, so that's the earlier work. What about her more recent pieces discussed?
In the last decade, Simpson has started using found photography, often from old Ebony and Jet magazines, as source notes for large format paintings and collages.
Ebony and Jet, icons of Black visual culture.
Right. The collages might feature magnified snowflakes superimposed on a striding Black man, or a woman's face swapped with her pet cheetahs. The paintings often merge images of individual women into composite portraits, screen printed with ink overlays, creating an uncanny amalgam. These anonymous women remain as opaque as the subjects of her earlier work.
Still resisting easy categorization.
Yes. There's also sculpture mentioned, stacks of Jet and Ebony magazines topped by a peeling bust of a Black woman, symbolizing monuments to an expression of Black culture rendered defunct by the magazine's end.
Wow, a commentary on cultural memory and loss.
And she even works with Arctic landscapes, constructed from vintage photos of glaciers, reworked with ink. These are linked to the Black navigator Matthew Henson, who accompanied Robert Peary to the North Pole. Simpson uses this, Himes argues, to invite viewers into the universal experience of the sublime while still holding on to the particularities of Black experience. There's a striking line. So much believed to be white is actually strikingly blue.
Connecting Black experience to the supposedly universal sublime, often coded white. That's fascinating.
Yeah. Other monumental works merge Black women's bodies with crashing waterfalls, or depict the meteorite hovering in space, connecting the sharecropper's plot to the galaxy, personal experience to vast time and space.
What's Simpson's stated intent, according to the review?
She aims to deploy the Black figure as a universal subject, challenging critical viewpoints that might limit her work to only being about the Black body. Her art offers freedom here, Simpson's freedom to experiment, the viewer's freedom to associate freely.
What's truly fascinating here, listening to this, is how Simpson deliberately resists clear interpretation.
Yes.
She forces the viewer to actively engage with the complex layers of meaning, particularly around identity and representation.
Yeah, you can't just glance at it and get it.
Yeah, exactly. By obscuring faces or using enigmatic texts or merging disparate images, she challenges our ingrained societal habits of categorization and judgment. She urges us to look beyond superficial readings and consider the universal human experience through a specific, often marginalized lens.
Using the specific to get at the universal.
Precisely. Her work challenges the power of conventional imagery to define and limit understanding, especially for Black female bodies, which have historically been so often objectified or narrowly defined in Western art and culture. This raises an important question about how art can do more than just reflect reality.
Right.
It can actively reshape our perceptions of the world by inviting a deeper, more introspective engagement with what we see and, crucially, the assumptions we bring to it.
So her art is less about showing you what to think and much more about making you think about how you think about what you're seeing.
Yeah.
That's a really powerful artistic approach. Okay, for our final article in this deep dive, we turn to, maybe surprisingly, a pop culture phenomenon, one that's surprising critics with its profound political depth. The Star Wars series, Andor.
Andor. Okay, I've heard great things about its political complexity, which is unusual for Star Wars.
Exactly. This is Jorge Cote's review, titled The Empire's Shadow. The core argument Cote makes is that Andor moves way beyond the simple good versus evil narrative we usually get in traditional Star Wars.
Right, Jedi versus Sith, light versus dark.
Yeah. Instead, Andor offers a realistic, granular depiction of how ordinary people become revolutionaries and the true, often brutal costs of building an insurgency against a fascist empire.
Realistic and granular in Star Wars. That is different.
It really is. Coe praises Andor for being a truly different Star Wars entry. He says it's more indebted to John Le Carre than George Lucas.
Le Carre, so espionage, moral ambiguity.
Exactly. Focusing on espionage, nuanced characters, and notably lacking Jedis or lightsabers entirely. It's lauded for its craft writing, acting, production design, and editing, and its meticulous attention to detail. This series distinguishes itself by exploring the murky ethical terrain of rebellion rather than presenting a clear-cut heroic fantasy.
So, less space opera, more political thriller. What's the story focus?
It tracks Cassian Andor's transformation. We first meet him as a petty thief, orphaned, cynical, and politically detached on the Empire-ruled salvage planet of Ferrix.
Starting from apathy, basically.
Totally. His exploits lead to the deaths of some security guards, which prompts the Empire to crack down hard on his community. This inadvertently thrusts him into the employ of Luthen Rail, played brilliantly by Stellan Skarsgård.
Yes.
Who was described as an underground puppet master of the nascent rebellion. Cassian's journey shows how he evolves from that cynical survivor into a leader who eventually teaches others that rebellions are built on hope.
From cynicism to hope, that's a compelling arc. What about the nuances of rebellion itself?
The show delves into that deeply. Rail, who Coate calls the Empire's Dark Twin in his methods, collaborates with complex figures like the militant radical Saw Gerrera and manages Senator Mon Mothma, who secretly finances insurgent activity while maintaining her imperial position.
The different factions and moral compromises within the rebellion.
Exactly. Meanwhile, the Imperial Security Bureau, ISB, featuring the chillingly ambitious Daedra Miro, tracks this nascent resistance network they call Axis. Season 1 focused on Cassian submitting to Rail's tutelage. Season 2, the review notes, accelerates the timeline, exploring the real cost of commitment to the cause.
The cost of commitment? That sounds heavy. How does it depict the Empire?
With painstaking granularity, according to Kite. It tracks the Empire's methods of subjugation. Cultural and ecological genocide, military occupation, enslaved prison labor, arbitrary sentences, constant checking papers and documentation, highly targeted propaganda, and fabricated and contrived justifications for military destruction.
Wow. It sounds like it draws parallels to real-world authoritarianism.
Kott explicitly says the horror lies in politics not far removed from our own. But it's not just about the big picture. It's also about small acts. The series features a catalyzing message from a manifesto written by a character named Nemec.
What's the message?
Random acts of insurrection are occurring constantly throughout the galaxy. Remember that the frontier of the rebellion is everywhere. And even the smallest act of insurrection pushes our lines forward.
Echoes of the A-line Mistel piece, in a way. The power of small acts.
Absolutely. This message is broadcast, passed like a blueprint for the kind of hope that makes rebellion possible. Ultimately, Andor asks, how ordinary people become revolutionaries, depicting the specific moments of defiance, resistance, and insurrection that make such a break possible.
This series raises a really important question about the effectiveness of narrative, especially pop culture narrative, in shaping political consciousness, doesn't it?
It seems uniquely positioned to do so.
Andor challenges those simplified good versus evil tropes we often find, maybe even expect, in popular media. It offers a more realistic and, frankly, sobering portrayal of systemic oppression and the arduous, often messy, process of building collective resistance.
Less about magic powers, more about hard choices.
Exactly. Its focus on the mundane but vital acts of defiance, the complex characters, and the inherent costs of commitment offers a far more resonant and perhaps more useful blueprint for thinking about revolution than the destined heroes typically depicted in Star Wars.
Yeah.
This suggests that even in fictional universes, the most compelling and potentially impactful stories are those that grapple honestly with the complex ethical dimensions of power, oppression, and revolution, maybe urging viewers to reflect on similar struggles in their own world.
It sounds like Andor is a masterclass in showing us that revolution isn't a simple hero's journey with a guaranteed happy ending, but a messy, difficult, costly, and deeply human endeavor. A valuable perspective, even from a galaxy far, far away. Outro. Wow, okay, what a journey through the September 2025 issue of The Nation. We've covered so much ground.
We really have.
From the fight for a truly universal care system, the complexities of economic populism, those urgent calls for transparency around the Epstein files, and the profound human impact of displacement and medical deportation. Just so much there.
And what's truly interesting, I think, is how these seemingly disparate issues start to weave together when you look at them side by side like this.
Exactly. We've seen arguments about how the tools of war can become the tools of class war.
Right, like in the Ackerman piece.
How small acts of individual resistance, like Mistel argued, can be just as crucial as large movements, and how even fictional galaxies, like in Andor, can mirror our own very real struggles against empire and oppression.
Absolutely. And we explored the evolving meaning of freedom with Foner, the cyclical nature of Red Scares with Cole, and the complex, multitudinous lives of American icons like Mark Twain and artists like Lorna Simpson who challenge our very perception.
All through a lens that consistently challenges us to look deeper, to question the surface narrative.
Yeah. If we try to connect this all to the bigger picture, what really emerges is this complex tapestry of struggle, yes, but also resilience.
Definitely resilience.
Whether it's the fight to redefine freedom, the artistic exploration of identity, or the historical echoes of Red Scares, a common thread seems to be the power of organized thought and collective action, and sometimes individual action, against forces that seek to simplify, obscure, or oppress.
Mm.
It underscores that understanding the why behind the news, the underlying systemic forces, the historical precedents, is just as important, maybe more important, than just knowing the what. These articles collectively demonstrate that pretty much every issue, from healthcare to foreign policy, from individual rights to artistic expression, is connected by these threads of power, justice, and the ongoing human struggle for dignity.
So what does this all mean for you, our listener? We've delved into these stories not just to, you know, inform you about the nation's content, but hopefully to provoke thought, to help you make connections in your own understanding of the world around you.
Yeah.
So as we wrap up this deep dive, here's maybe a final provocative thought for you to mull over. If knowledge and information are indeed power, as the saying goes, what responsibility do we each hold in actively seeking out and understanding the hidden connections between seemingly disparate issues? Especially when those connections might reveal uncomfortable truths about power, privilege, and the very definition of freedom in our society today.
That's a great question to leave people with. Thank you for joining us on this deep dive. We certainly hope it has given you much to reflect on.
Until next time, keep digging deeper. I'm Lee Garrison.
And I'm Charlie Olmsted.